This is 40 AM in 5, a download of 40 AM LLC, recorded at 7 PM Eastern Time on Sunday, February 16th. I'm Chris Bohm, and welcome back to this, our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, the Microsoft board chooses a new CEO, only the third in its history. Recent amplification denial-of-service attacks using the network time protocol are spotlighted by the BBC. The CNIL in France makes demands of Google for its search engine site, while Google continues its appeal. European Union officials confirm revised expectations for possible conclusion on the draft data protection regulation. Possible new legislation and cyber preparedness in the wake of the Target and Neiman Marcus data breaches. A spotlight from the American Automobile Association on automotive telematics. The U.S. government releases its voluntary framework for cybersecurity. And Fed Chair Janet Yellen gives her first biannual testimony before the House Finance Committee. But first today, let's talk about Microsoft. On Tuesday, February 4th, the board of Microsoft Corp. chose an internal candidate, 46-year-old Indian-American engineer Satya Nadella, to replace CEO Steve Ballmer, who has held the position since 2000. As only the third CEO in Microsoft's history, Mr. Nadella hails from the southern Indian city of Hyderabad. He earned his bachelor's degree in electronics and communication engineering from Manipal University, a master's in computer science at the University of Wisconsin, and an MBA from the University of Chicago. Mr. Nadella has been with Microsoft since 1992, most recently as overseer of the cloud infrastructure beneath such Microsoft services as Bing, Xbox, Live Office 365, and Windows Azure, which has most recently become a much more serious competitor to Amazon's cloud product. As such, it is not unexpected that Mr. Nadella will be poised to attempt to reconstitute Microsoft as a devices and services company, capitalizing on this architecture and the services it can bring. Online security experts Cloudflare, as reported by the BBC, indicated last week that hackers have exploited weaknesses in the network time protocol to launch a massive denial-of-service cyber attack. The NTP is typically used by systems on the internet in order to synchronize computer clocks. There are thousands of NTP servers throughout the world, and there have been few changes to the system since its introduction in 1985. A computer that needs to synchronize will send the NTP a request and a small amount of data and receive data in return. In this case, according to the BBC reporter David Lee, the hackers seem to have exploited two weaknesses. One, the fact that the NTP typically sends back a data pack bigger than it receives, which means that an attack can be amplified. And second, the location of the original computer can be spoofed, tricking the NTP into sending the data response back to somewhere else. Cloudflare's chief executive told the BBC that they had detected a denial-of-service attack of about 400 gigabits per second, with the hackers using many machines to make requests to the NTP and then having the responses spoofed back to a single target in order to overwhelm the target with data. Amplification attacks like this, according to the BBC, result from an attacker turning a small amount of bandwidth coming from a small number of machines into a massive traffic load, hitting a victim from around the internet. Such attacks are becoming more common, and often the most effective response is simply to shut off the connection once technologies in the network can detect the massive amounts of traffic heading to one location. The French National Commission for Computing and Civil Liberties, or CNIL, is that country's data protection or privacy regulator. In January, the CNIL imposed a rare fine and punishment on Google for alleged violations with regard to how it tracked and stored user information. In addition to a $200,000 fine, Google was also required to display a notice on its French search page, not only acknowledging the fine, but also indicating that it was due to Google's tracking efforts. The order, tantamount to a scarlet letter on Google's French search page, is one of the first of its kind. National Public Radio's Scott Newman reported last week that initially Google had fought both the fine and the order, but by February 7th, it had preliminarily acquiesced, saying in an emailed statement to NPR that We've engaged fully with the Keneal throughout this process to explain our privacy policy and how it allows us to create simpler, more effective services. The statement continues that they will continue with their appeal before the French Council of State while complying with the order to post the notice. In her speech on January 28th, Data Protection Day 2014, EU Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding affirmed that the EU needs to get serious on data protection, and that the European Commission, the two European Parliament reporters, and the Greek and incoming Italian presidencies of the EU have all agreed on a roadmap to get the data protection reform agreed to before the end of the year. Considering that the 1995 Data Protection Directive took 5 years to negotiate, she added that this is a rather good result. The original goal was to have the present EU Parliament vote on the package of reforms in April before the May parliamentary elections, but the deal announced would make that highly unlikely. It has now been 2 years since the first draft of a data protection regulation was tabled, a draft that sought to harmonize European data protection national rules out of what are presently myriad variations on the original 1995 single European framework for privacy law. The Parliament's Civil Liberties Committee had been given the mandate in October to begin negotiations after having developed a text that found consensus among reportedly over 3,000 amendments. But the summit in December among EU member state governments failed to develop an agreed way forward. German Green MEP Jan-Philipp Albrecht, author of the Parliament's report on the draft, confirmed to the EU Observer on January 28th that a current timetable now aims for Parliament deliberations in June, with interinstitutional negotiations in July. The EU Observer also reported that some European insiders are hopeful that member states will at least reach partial agreement in March, with a full agreement possible by mid-summer. At issue, though, are several European member states, including the UK, Denmark, Hungary, and Slovenia, who would prefer a directive rather than a regulation, in effect, less harmonization of European rules and preservation of the existing freedom among member states to legislate national differences in privacy requirements. Although such an approach could potentially lead to some member states implementing looser and more business-friendly privacy rules, the continuation of a European environment where privacy requirements vary greatly across borders increases the costs and complexity for cross-border services, businesses, and compliance. Critics of the present directive-based scheme cite that winners in such a scenario have largely been the legal community in the past. Stories last week in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and by National Public Radio all underscore that recent credit card data breaches at Target and Neiman Marcus are leading U.S. lawmakers to advance legislative options to curb cyber thefts. One of the primary reforms being considered is something that we reported on 2 weeks ago, advancing the conversion in the U.S. from standard magnetic strip credit cards to chip-enabled EMV smart cards or magnetic EMV hybrids. Whereas Asian and European markets long ago began their switchovers, the costs attributable to changing software and point-of-sale machines among U.S. retailers to enable the use of the cards has been cited as cost-prohibitive in the short term. The most recent data breaches, their breadth, and the attendant costs have reportedly changed that dynamic, with Target Chief Financial Officer John Mulligan testifying on Capitol Hill earlier this month that all of us have to move together simultaneously. According to NPR, Visa and MasterCard are aiming to have chips in the majority of their U.S. cards by October 2015, but installation of the retail readers may take longer. Another plan, key to Senator Al Franken, Democrat of Minnesota, would be to tighten data theft disclosure and security standards. At present, there is no federal law setting out clear security standards that merchants and data brokers need to meet, or federal requirements for companies to notify customers when data has been compromised. At a Senate hearing on February 11th, both retailers and security companies reportedly signaled support for both improvements to federal rules. However, indications are, as of late last week, that the Target breach was likely facilitated, at least in part, by a physical security breach. PC Magazine, Reuters, and NPR each reported that a Pennsylvania-based HVAC or air conditioning subcontractor to Target may have been where hackers exploited a remote data access point in order to gain access to Target servers. The story, first reported by security researcher and journalist Brian Krebs, was in part confirmed by the HVAC firm on February 7th. The data accessed by the subcontractor into Target reportedly existed purely for billing, contract management, and project management, but hackers may have exploited the client-vendor connection to hack into otherwise segmented parts of Target's network. It is unclear at this stage whether the breach was facilitated by logical or cybersecurity breaches, physical security lapses through passwords or other physical access to data lines, or most likely a combination of both. However, the method of access through a subcontracted facilities firm to Target does underscore that cybersecurity and threat mitigation remain as much an issue of governing physical access to lines, passwords, and databases as it does guarding against the sophistication of a technological attack. In their January-February edition, the American Automobile Association's World Magazine reported on automotive telematics, the wireless transmission of useful information to and from a vehicle. It gives your car the ability to share and obtain data almost anywhere in the world. Telematics data can be exchanged via satellite. This is most often GPS or entertainment content, or more commonly through a mobile wireless connection, either embedded in the vehicle or established through a driver's smartphone. The AAA World piece also highlighted that these data channels may soon be joined by dedicated short-range communications, local radio transmissions, for safety-related information about surrounding vehicles and driving conditions. As a car owner or a driver, the opportunities from these data exchanges are just now coming into view. Through your car, you can find a place to eat, find out how to get there, keep from getting too close to the car in front of you, and even perhaps help purchase an advance movie ticket to help you bypass the line at the box office. But also, apart from recording your location and food and music and movie tastes, your car may be keeping tabs on your aggressive driving habits, abrupt lane changes, hard braking, speeding, or the fact that you weren't wearing a seatbelt. Now, some of this information may have been transmitted to the automaker, while other information simply gets stored away for another party and perhaps another day. What sets today's telematics apart from car data generation of even 1 or 2 years ago is that many of today's cutting-edge driver tools use computer vision aids, including ultrasonic, infrared, radar, and LIDAR, which is laser-based radar, and camera sensors to generate a real-time electronic picture of your driving environment. Some of the latest advances spotlighted by the AAA World include automated emergency braking, adaptive cruise control to maintain safe distances, blind spot monitoring, lane departure warning and correction, pedestrian approach monitoring and warnings as to driver alertness. In addition, information from your car's onboard computer, now critical to vehicle repair, is in some cases being restricted by vehicle manufacturers, including access to repair codes and/or charging for gaining access to this data. In these cases, inhibiting access or making the access to repair data more costly to non-dealers locks independent repair shops out of the process and forces consumers to preference dealers for repair, making data access a possible anti-competitive leverage. In many ways, the opportunities inherent in automotive telematics and the privacy-related concerns are a ripe proving ground for one of the key debates in privacy law at present. How do we square the burgeoning opportunities inherent in big data analytics with traditional customer consent strategies and notice terms and conditions? All those license agreements and privacy policies that many routinely zip past, quickly choosing "I agree" when you update an operating system or install new software on your phone, tablet, or home computer, very likely contain language explaining what about you will be noted and passed on to a third party, sometimes even for a fee. While the need for a clear checkbox of consent has for lawyers long been a holy grail, the consumers and their choices far too often fall down the rabbit hole of interminable language as they pull the lever saying "I agree." This, in part, treads upon the notion of what is or isn't truly voluntary. The concerns over the ability of a consent to truly be voluntary on the part of the consumer and adequately cover the company collecting the information continues to stir the debate in privacy circles at present, to perhaps have such far more preemptive principles as data collection limitations and use restrictions become far stronger components in national laws, and perhaps be preferred to the limitations of consent in a data-heavy world. The American Automobile Association believes that your telematics-generated data from your vehicle belongs to you, that your driving and behavior generates it, creating your ownership. In many cases, you may have paid $50,000 for the car. Shouldn't you own the information it's producing and be able to control where it goes, to whom, and how it's used? For more information on automotive telematics, see AAA World's January-February issue. And to read more about the current debate over the validity of consent strategies for the protection of consumer data rights versus collection and use limitations, there are several current articles available through the Oxford Internet Institute, the Center for Democracy and Technology, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, and also several articles published by 40ANM within the past year as available on our website. On Wednesday, February 12th, the U.S. government released a framework for cybersecurity meant for voluntary adoption by the private sector. Under the direction of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the framework has been in development for roughly a year since the President signed into effect Executive Order 13636 in February of 2013, authorizing creation of the framework in the wake of Congress's inability to pass acceptable legislation to enable a cybersecurity strategy. The newly released framework has not changed much from the version released in draft from NIST in October of this past year, although several have pointed out that it no longer contains an appendix dedicated to the issue of privacy and civil liberties controls as it did in October. NIST had previewed in January that it would be pulling this material, given lack of private sector support for it, but it's also stressed the voluntary nature of the framework. Companies that want to adopt the framework will most likely be seeking to align and target their cybersecurity practices against its five overarching organizational functions, including identify, protect, detect, respond, and recover components. Executive Order 13636 will require federal regulatory agencies to report by May of this year as to whether they feel that they have clear authority to establish requirements based upon the framework to sufficiently address current and projected cyber risks to critical infrastructure. Some have viewed this mandate as a possible indication that the framework might someday be considered mandatory. But at least for the moment, its voluntary nature means that federal agencies might not initially know the full extent of its adoption and utility, since the framework does not require contact with the government, reporting, or statistical gathering once the framework is downloaded. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which issued a somewhat supportive statement on release of the framework, much still remains to be seen in terms of how the cyber framework is implemented and revised, especially in terms of what roles regulatory agencies and departments will play. On Tuesday, February 11th, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen gave her first Humphrey Hawkins testimony before the House Finance Committee. She called the U.S. economic recovery in the labor market far from complete, noting that the continued high numbers of long-term unemployment and part-time workers need our attention. But yet, she highlighted that the job market has made progress since the Fed started its most recent round of stimulus in 2012, citing the drop in the unemployment rate from 8.1% to 6.6% as indicative of this. Janet Yellen testified that she expects to continue the strategy laid out by her predecessor, Ben Bernanke, winding down the Fed's bond buying program. But she believes that the program has largely been successful, affirming her belief in the power of quantitative easing as a tool of monetary policy. The Fed has in fact been cutting back on its purchases to the tune of about $10 billion per month since January, and is likely to continue such measured tapering through the expected end of the program later this year. When asked about most recent reports noting job creation in the past 2 months at a lower rate than expected, Chairwoman Yellen noted that the Federal Open Market Committee and others should be careful not to jump to conclusions, as, like many viewers of the job market, she felt that weather played as much a role in the weakness. The chair's remarks largely seemed to shore up investor confidence in global markets, which posted gains through Wednesday in the wake of her remarks in both Asia and London. And that will be all for us this week. You have been listening to 40ANM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from the AAA World, the BBC, National Public Radio, the New York Times, and the European Observer. Thank you for listening. 40 AM and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, February 24th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.